You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past few years, New York Magazine named Karen Russell one of the 27 most impressive New Yorkers under the age of 26. She was included in the New Yorkers list of the top 20 young writers under 40 and cited by the National Book Foundation as one of the top 5 writers under the age of 35, and all before she'd published her first novel. But now that much-anticipated debut novel has been released by Knopf. It's called Swamplandia, and it's a serial comic coming-of-age story set in a rundown alligator-themed tourist trap in southern Florida. I'm very pleased that it has brought Karen Russell to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
I want to make it clear that both your novel and the alligator theme park at the center of the book are named Swamplandia with an exclamation point at the end of it. It drove my spell check crazy.
I think it drives some readers crazy because it keeps recurring, right? But that just seemed like the right syntax for this sort of dilapidated theme park.
Did you visit family-owned alligator parks like Swamplandia when you were a kid?
Oh, definitely, definitely. We were big fans of all the jungles, Parrot Jungle, Monkey Jungle, and all of our field trips. You know, that's the big advantage of growing up in South Florida.
You were in Miami?
I was in Miami, yeah. And so, you would sign the release form, and then all these 10-year-olds go out on an airboat to watch a man, you know, essentially sit on a gator on this strange island, and then you go back to math class in the afternoon.
And now you can go to South Beach to watch the exotic animals.
Right.
But I'm sure the places like this still exist in Florida. Or was this something that ended in the 70s or so?
I think that I miss sort of the crest of these roadside attraction parks because people I've spoken to on sort of the reading jag through Florida have really specific memories. I mean, people will come up to me and say, oh, this is Jungle Larry, you know, or this is based on, you know, Everglade Wonder Park. And then some of these places have closed. But you can definitely go out there and still, you know, go on Uncle Al's swamp boat tour, things like that.
Well, your story takes place in the 1,000 Islands region. Is that within the Everglades?
It's part of the park. It's on the Gulf side. So this is a chain of mangrove islands, this really labyrinth-like, beautiful expanse that's on the southwest side.
Has it remained underdeveloped?
Relative to other places, yes, because some of these tree islands are so small that you can't actually develop there. I mean, they're not practical for habitation, and it's also now within the bounds of the national parks. So.
Swamplandia is owned and operated by the Big Tree family, which when the novel opens includes a mother and father, their 3 children, and their grandfather. How did this family come to own and operate an alligator park? I mean, they're from Ohio.
They're a bunch of white Protestants from Ohio, and they sort of drift down the spine of the continent. They were duped by the same land, the original land scam. We've got other mortgage problems right now in Florida, but in the 20s there was this swamp boom, and people were selling these like phantasmagoric, beautiful land, you know, buy your farm. It's going to be an American Eden, year-round growing season. So this family comes down there and discovers their farm is under 6 feet of water.
And their name is Shadrach. How did they come to be the Big Tree family?
The Shadrachs. I sort of think they're like the original American grifters. You know, like so many of their contemporaries, they're inventing a noble tradition for themselves. So they sort of cut their losses. This isn't going to be a farm. It turns out that the grandmother has an aptitude for wrestling alligators. She has some affinity with these monsters. So they rename themselves the Big Tree Tribe and sort of do a very shallow reading of, you know, Native American culture and they're hustlers essentially.
But everybody associates the Everglades with the Seminole Indians,
right?
Who have never signed a peace treaty with the United States government.
Isn't that fantastic? I didn't know that before I researched this book. Nor did I know that the Everglades aren't their native land. You know, they're sort of our indigenous Indians, but they themselves are displaced Creeks.
Yeah, they were pushed into this place that nobody else wanted.
Exactly, yeah.
The family maintains a museum that tourists can visit with their admission to the Alligator Park, containing real and fake family memorabilia. And I got the impression that you had fun creating that museum, as well as the park's tacky gift shop and snack bar, because it's really funny.
Oh, thank you. I really did get a kick out of that. You know, I have a perverse love for all that ticky-tacky stuff in Florida. And I like the idea, too, of a family museum where these people, you know, they're trumping up their noble traditions, but what's in the museum is just any family's crap. You know, it's like your old shoes, the TV that's busted, and they're trying to pass this stuff off as their you know, Indian artifacts.
When the novel opens, there's a crisis. The Alligator wrestler Helola Bigtree has just died of cervical cancer, leaving the show without its star performer and also leaving her three teenage children motherless. And the park is facing competition from a hell-themed amusement park called World of Darkness that's open nearby.
Right.
How many theme parks are there in Florida?
If you go to Miami, you can drive past the Miami Sea Aquarium and the Coral Castle on your way to, you know, Publix grocery store. So it really, it sort of seemed like every third business when I was growing up was some kind of fantasy land.
Although the visitors to the park are there as much for the cheap beer as they are to watch the alligator show.
Yeah, I think the Big Tree show sort of evolves a little bit to meet the market. So they discount their gator tots and their beer.
Now, what did you start with here? This family that was in trouble because the grandfather is about to be moved to a retirement home. Mother has died. Was that where you began, or did you begin with the idea of an alligator theme park and then come up with a family to fit into it?
So this grew out of a short story I'd written a billion years ago in graduate school, Ava Wrestles the Alligator. And I think my original idea was about these two sisters who were sort of stranded on this decaying theme park in the wake of their mother's death. So the family's sort of always been around. And Ava, who's sort of the heart of the book, has been with me for a long time.
She's 13 years old.
Right. A very stunted, weird 13.
You could have also told it from her older sister's perspective. Mm-hmm. Osceola. She also has a brother named Kiwi. How do they wind up with these weird names?
Well, Osceola is the famous war chief who never signed the truce. So he's sort of the fiercest Seminole warrior, which is ended up being kind of a misnomer for this girl who's this really oddball, girly girl, you know, pale and bad at wrestling alligators. And Kiwi Bigtree is the nerdy brother in the family. He's the rebel because he wants to go to college instead of wrestle the gators. And I think Kiwi seemed like an appropriately sort of effeminate name for him.
It's always difficult when you tell a story from the viewpoint of a child.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get past it? Because you can't give them too much knowledge, but at the same time, they have to know enough to tell the story.
That's exactly right. And it's a tricky thing because I sort of have a good time on the sentence level, just fiddling with language and wanting to flower it up. So if you're going to do kind of Emma Donahue in Room, for example, limits herself to the consciousness of this 5-year-old, and it's a very narrow gauge. She's really going to have that constraint in place and only speak in a vocabulary of a 5-year-old. I sort of thought Ava is narrating in a retrospective way. So I give her access to adult language, but I tried not to overstep what a 13-year-old girl would really know about the world.
But you do write the sections of the book that describe Kiwi's experiences after he leaves the island in third person.
Right.
You didn't allow him to use his own voice?
You know, when I tried those sections in the first person, he sounded sort of uncomfortably close to Ava to me. And I sort of like the aerial view for that. That's the more comic of the two storylines, sort of the slapsticky, big picture, Dickensian, you know, huge place, as opposed to this really sort of mysterious nightmarish swamp. So that seemed more appropriate to have the aerial view the third person allows.
Are your short stories also often slapsticky?
I think, unfortunately, yes, man. I think I crack myself up when I'm cracking no one else up too frequently. You know?
You mean you're writing something and you think of something funny and you type it in and then laugh?
Oh, well, no, not out loud. Oh, my goodness. There lies the path of madness, right? But, yeah, I do really enjoy writing in some bad jokes. And a lot of the revision ended up, you know, being vacuuming out the bad jokes from 2007 or something.
Well, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit. I don't know if there'll be any bad jokes in the reading. Karen Russell is here. Will you,
sure.
you choose something? Karen Russell's first novel is Swamplandia. She is the author of St. Lucie's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, which got a lot of praise when that was published, that short story collection. Now her first novel, which is published by Knopf. What are you going to read for us?
I thought just the first page, the Occam's Razor. So this is the chapter one, The Beginning of the End. Our mother performed in starlight. Whose innovation this was, I never discovered. Probably it was Chief Bigtree's idea, and it was a good one. To blank the follow spot and let a sharp moon cut across the sky, unchaperoned. To kill the microphone. To leave the stage lights tin eyelids scrolled and give the tourists in the stands a chance to enjoy the darkness of our island. To encourage the whole stadium to gulp air along with Swamplandia's star performer, the world-famous alligator wrestler, Hylola Bigtree. 4 times a week, our mother climbed the ladder above the gator pit in a green two-piece bathing suit and stood on the edge of the diving board, breathing. If it was windy, her long hair flew around her face, but the rest of her stayed motionless. Nights in the swamp were dark and star leopard. Our island was 30-odd miles off the grid of mainland lights. And although your naked eye could easily find the ball of Venus and the sapphire hairs of the Pleiades, our mother's body was just lines, a smudge against the palms. Somewhere directly below Hylola Bigtree, dozens of alligators pushed their icicle overbites and the awesome diamonds of their heads through over 300,000 gallons of filtered water. The deep end, the black cone where Mom dove, was 27 feet. At its shallowest point, the water tapered to 4 inches of muck that lapped at coppery sand. A small spoil island rose out of the center of the pit, a quarter acre of dredged limestone, and during the day, 30 gators at a time crawled into a living mountain on the rocks to sun themselves.
Karen Russell reading from Swamplandia, her new novel published by Knopf. I know somebody who tells the story of swimming with an alligator in the Keys, an alligator named Betty. And nobody ever believes her when she tells that story. But here you have these alligators. Family members are swimming with them and wrestling them. And Ava even raises an unusual red-colored alligator from birth in secret and carries it with her in the pocket of her shirt. So are alligators less frightening than they look?
No, I think that they're still so terrifying. I love that Betty was amenable to, you know, was friendly towards human swimmers.
Until somebody threw a beer can and hit her on the nose and then she became scary.
Well, and that's the thing, right? I think that the way that they smile, they're easy to anthropomorphize. And yet when you see one, they do seem so utterly alien. You know, they have this reputation for being living fossils. And I that's what I always loved about them, even as a kid, that you get this sense that they are just an irreducibly mysterious creature.
But I get a feeling that people and the damage they've caused are the real monsters of this book.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think the real menace is all human in this particular book.
Now, I mentioned earlier that you have been put on all these lists of the most promising people under a certain age. And then the book is getting terrific reviews. In her New York Times review, Janet Maslin said, "You know how to use bizarre ingredients to absolutely irresistible effect," and called you one in a million and this novel a marvel. I'm worried for you.
Leonard, me too. I mean, this has so far exceeded any of my expectations. I was just so glad when Knopf agreed to publish this weird thing, you know. So it has been really wonderful, to the extent that I wonder if this isn't, you know, some giant, you know, Stephen King Carrie-style prank being played on me or something.
Did you see yourself as a short story writer until you started working on this book?
Absolutely, I did. And then I just felt, I felt like this, like a scam artist like these Bigtrees, where I had promised to write a novel and had no idea how to do that. So for a long time, you know, it sort of feels like those condominium developments that you have to buy before they're erected. And so they're like, this is where the swimming pool will go, and having no idea, you know, how to do any of that construction. So I sort of learned while writing this.
Karen Russell is a writer in residence at Bard College these days. Her novel, Swamplandia, with an exclamation point, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Leonard.